Hi, welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program I bring the cutting edge of consciousness, thought, new ideas to the show, and tonight we'll make a little departure from my investigations into other subjects, and we'll focus more on the understanding of our economy, because it seems like we are in some kind of a desperate shape, and my guest is an expert. He's a professor of law at Syracuse University. He's also an expert on binary economics and really the whole understanding of what makes an economy, I would say, function correctly. His name is Robert Ashford. Robert, you're here with us?
I'm here.
I'd love to talk about binary economics, but I just also want to really talk about also what's going on in the market, stock market. I mean, we can fit binary economics in if we understand the current economic climate, and I think people say we are really in desperate times. Is that true? Can you give us an analysis of what's going on the last couple of days, and then we'll talk about, you know, your specialty. So what do you think?
Sure. Well, in a way, we have been in difficult times for many years, and it's just a question of when things hit the fan and when things come to a head and when reckonings come about. I think this crisis could have been foreseen, the present crisis could have been foreseen a long time ago. So in a way, we can deal with an immediate crisis, or we can look at long-term trends that brought us where we are, and it's important to look at, you know, all of these things.
But right. Go ahead.
Well, the crisis we're in right now has to do with a combination of people getting into home purchases that they couldn't afford, getting suckered into interest rates that start low, hook you low, and then build up high. An increasing bubble in the real estate market, where the prices are raising more and more and more. Cash is made available for that. And then people lending on the assumption that things are going to keep on going up. Then you've got people who are selling the mortgages, not holding on to them, but putting them into the syndicating them, packaging them, and selling them to investors.
Okay,
investment houses getting involved. So it's a series of things culminated in where we are.
A couple of things. I mean, you saw it coming. I mean, obviously, but and also we'll talk a little bit about that. But also the thing that is really the backbone of everything you mentioned is money. What is money? How is it really used or misused in this culture? How can, like, something like Lehman Brothers go under? There's something about money that doesn't make sense in the equation. And can you kind of express what's below the common understanding of how money and economy works? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah. That's a huge question, and in a way, I think that I once heard someone say the problem with many economists is that they don't understand money, and people in general have difficulties with money. I can say this, that money functions as a series of functions. One is that it is a medium of exchange, and the simplest level. Instead of bartering, we have these tokens that represent the value of what we've made, what we've produced. Mm-hmm. And so we do our work and we get a value, a token for that, and then we exchange it for other things. So on one level, money is simply a medium of exchange.
Right.
It allows us to not have multi-party barter. That's one function of money.
I understand that, but just to interrupt for one second, or
sure.
Maybe you'll cover it, is that in the stock market, and in whatever speculation, we've kind of lost the value of this exchange. So go ahead, continue, if you can just include that.
A second function of money is that it is what they call a store of value,
uh-huh.
meaning to say if... If you work and you get paid for what you do, you don't want necessarily to immediately turn it into consumption. It's kind of it stores your value of what you've done, and then you can exchange that for other things in the future. So it's a store of value. It's a medium of exchange. Money is also at its heart, it is debt, meaning to say that when the government prints a dollar bill, it is saying that it will stand behind that dollar bill with the credit of the U.S. So money is actually a form of debt. It's what the government owes anybody who holds it. Now, we used to back debt with like gold. It used to have to be on a gold standard, so there'd be a certain amount of gold. And now it really is just simply the money producing capacity of the nation, of the government. The government ultimately will either tax cover its debt, its money out there, or it will borrow. So it's one or the other, or it will produce things. Actually, the government, in some instances, like the Tennessee Valley, it actually produces things. The government is actually a producer in some circumstances.
But
so money is all those three things.
But you're saying that it's the government, and the last thing that is backing it by its word. How does the government?
I mean, it's a wonderful question. Ultimately, it is in the power of the government either to tax the productive activity of others, or to borrow with the promise to pay it back in the future, or in some small number of instances, it's actually the government producing things. In some instances, the government actually is a proprietor, and the Tennessee Valley is an example of that. The government owns land and rents it out, so there's some things that the government produces, but it is, in a sense, debt chasing debt. That is to say, it is the promise to pay in the future for obligations incurred in the past.
Okay, so this might be a simple question, but how does the stock market work, and what is all this buying and selling that, in a way, has nothing to do with this paper currency, or probably does somewhere, but it seems like that's off on a whole other avenue, the whole stock market thing.
Well, when you talk about the stock market, you're talking about people investing financial capital, in companies, private companies, that produce things.
Mm-hmm.
General Motors produces, Ford produces, utilities produce, IBM produces, the Microsoft. These are companies that are producing something. So they're spending, they themselves are hiring capital, goods and labor, tools and machines and labor to produce things. Those things are sold in the market to people who themselves have earned in order to be able to buy things. And that's reflected in these companies that have an earning capacity. So people who have saved money, that is, say they've earned more than they've spent on consumer goods, can invest in these companies with the idea that they will promise a profit and then return value to the shareholders.
Right. That's very idealistic, but it seems like there's people investing in companies and investing in who actually don't have money but just credit, and this is sort of what's crescendo to this breaking point now, right? I mean, is that what happened?
I don't think most of the investment in the stock market is an investment that is done on what you might call leverage. That is to say, it is true that some people borrow money in order to invest in stocks, and there are, within the securities and exchange laws, there are limits to how much you can borrow to buy stock. Credit limits on that score. I don't think the problem so much is that investors have borrowed to invest in companies. I think the deepest problem is that people lack the earning capacity to support the production that we can create right now. We have we have a far greater productive capacity than people have the capacity to purchase.
Wait, so you, let me just understand that. So you say we have the capacity to produce more goods than people can buy? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say if we step away from this sort of this series of current problems, which has to do with people buying homes they can't afford, people getting suckered into lower interest rates that then jump up later, selling these mortgages to Wall Street, and then loaning on the promise that the next round of value will just keep on going up, the bubble in the real estate market. All these things have an underlying symptom, and the underlying cause of this is that people don't have the earning capacity to continue supporting our productive capacity.
Wait, so it's usually supply and demand, right? The supply is equal to the demand. Now you're saying we have... So did the manufacturing and the production get out of control to the demand? Is that what's... You're saying has happened?
What I'm suggesting is, and I guess one could say that this is a, you could see it as a Keynesian perspective. Mm-hmm. The market does not distribute the purchasing power to the people sufficiently to enable people to buy what we can produce. We can produce more houses than people can afford to buy. We can produce more cars than people can afford to buy. We can produce almost more of anything, everything,
right,
that people can afford. It is a fundamental lack in the distribution of earning capacity that, to me, is the underlying cause of these issues.
Sorry, but you think it's the earning capacity, or do you think it's the overzealous... enthusiasm of the production that's out of touch with the demands? I mean, it seems like it's not an earning capacity problem. It seems like the problem's on the other side, right?
Well,
with this industry.
It's a combination of different errors, and you can look at the fact that we in some instances produce more cars than we can purchase, but I don't think that that it reflects the biggest part of the problem. People make mistakes, they overproduce, sometimes they design things that people don't want to buy, from my perspective, and I guess it does go into this issue of binary economics, from my perspective, the difficulty is that we are trying to distribute the earning capacity of capital and labor only through jobs and welfare. Most people don't own anything, and since most people don't own anything, they don't have the earnings of capital. And since they don't have the earnings of capital, they can't afford to buy what is produced.
Okay.
I think there is sometimes over-exuberance.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people make mistakes and they produce more things than people can buy, but certainly when you get these bubbles like this housing market going up and up and up, each person depending upon being able to flip a house over to somebody else, these bubbles do exist.
Mm-hmm.
But from my perspective, they are the tip of the iceberg of the fundamental problem. Problem, as far as I can see, is most goods and services are largely produced by capital.
Now, explain capital for people who don't understand what you mean by capital.
Well, very good. First of all, there are two distinctly different uses of the word capital. One use is the way the father of economics, Adam Smith and Karl Marx, mm-hmm, and John Maynard Keynes and Alfred Marshall, who brought us the neoclassical school. That means capital means land, machines, tools, structures, processes, productive process, anything that's non-human and is used in the productive process. That's what you might call real capital. And if you were drawing a balance sheet, it would be the assets of a company, the productive assets of a company.
Okay, I got you.
And then there's another definition of capital, and that's called financial capital.
Mm.
And that's represented by stocks and bonds. That's a claim on real capital. Financial capital and real capital are very different. And one of the reasons people are confused about economics is that we continually use the term in two fundamentally different ways. One is the real machines and tools and structures and patents and the land that is used in production. Those things are really doing a part of the work, just like labor does a part of the work.
Uh-huh.
The other thing is just a claim on the profits of those real things, and that's what we call financial capital.
So you're saying the hardcore, the hands-on capital generates financial capital. I mean, and then that capital then builds on itself. Is that what you're
saying? Well, I would say that the real capital is a part of what produces profits.
Uh-huh.
And the profits are paid to people who have financial capital. So, I mean, look at it from this point of view. If you want to start up a company, somebody might put up $1 million to start up a company.
Okay.
The managers will take that $1 million and invest in tools and equipment, and they'll also pay labor. They'll engage in a process. They'll produce a gross revenues, which are what the company takes in.
Uh-huh.
They'll pay their expenses. They'll pay their employees. They'll pay the taxes. They'll pay the operator, and then they'll end up with a profit. And that profit gets paid to the owner who invested $1 million. So so we've got there the $1 million going into the company. It's turned into assets, real capital.
And then
there's some obligations like the payroll obligations, and if there's any borrowed money, and then the bottom line, then the, below that there's the equity owner, the part that the owner gets. That's his financial capital, and that's a claim on the profits after all the expenses have been taken out.
It's whatever percentage, and you're saying instead of putting the money back into the business, it goes back to the owner for his own.
He might leave it in the business. If, for example, you invest, you start up a company with $1 million in the first year after all expenses, it has a, let's say, a 15% profit. Well, unless there's a dividend paid, that company will be worth $1,150,000, which is the original investment plus 15% more. Now, the owner can either take that as a dividend, or that owner can keep it in the company. If he takes it as a dividend, he's left with that financial capital of $1 million. If he leaves it in the company, his financial capital has grown to $1,150,000. It's grown because it's a claim on those real assets.
Okay, I get that. So, that's capital. Okay.
That's financial, yeah. That's the difference.
That's the regular way of looking at capital. We're going to get a little radical here, I think, as we get into more binary economics. So there's capital, and then what's the other side of capital?
Well, you've got the real capital and the one side of which is the left-hand side of the balance sheet, and you've got the financial capital, which is a claim on that, on the other side. And that's a process that goes on. The question that arises, if you look at the economy today versus 100 years ago or 200 years ago, what's producing most of the wealth today? Is it labor or is it capital? And that gets down to a very fundamental question. Economists would say that capital's producing most of the wealth.
Wait, that was the other side of the equation. There's capital, and then there's labor.
Yes.
So that's the two sides. There's real capital, financial capital, and then there's just labor. You just want to define labor as the energy that people put in.
Labor is the human input. Labor is the human input. If we produce something. You see, I guess we go back to the traditional way of understanding the role of capital, and I mean now real capital,
mm-hmm.
is that capital makes labor more productive. So if you ask a deep question of why can we produce many times more today than 100 years ago,
uh-huh.
the traditional answer is that, well, because labor is much more productive because capital makes labor more productive.
Now, without getting economic, I think I understand what you're saying, but just put it in ordinary language in the sense that what actually makes labor more productive? What is the thing that capital's doing that makes labor more productive?
Well, the best way to understand that is to look at how Adam Smith looks at it and how most mm-hmm. economists look at it, which I think is an error, but it's an error that is embedded in our system. Let's suppose you can saw 10 boards an hour with a handsaw.
Okay.
And let's suppose you instead invest in a machine saw.
The
same laborer now can saw 100 boards an hour rather than 10 boards an hour. So we say by using the machine, the person is 10 times as productive.
Okay, so that's how capital, in this case, would make labor more productive.
That's the vision. That's the way they see it. Or, you know, you dig a hole in 4 hours by hand, you get a shovel, you can do it in 1 hour. Capital makes labor more, and that's the fundamental way we look at things today.
But
human
you're seeing it differently. You're seeing something else here, right?
Because the binary economist looks at the great growth that we had since, let's say, 1776, 1876, 1976. I mean, you can look at movies, get an idea of the size of the economy today compared to years past.
Yeah.
Here's the way we look at it. You haul a sack a mile, you're exhausted. I mean, it's a pretty heavy sack, and you go a mile, you're probably exhausted.
Right.
You put 10 sacks on a horse
and
go twice as far in half the time, and you're maybe riding the horse even, or at least you're leading it. You're doing much more work, but it's really not you who's doing the extra work.
It's the horse.
The horse has done something very important beyond making you more productive.
Uh-huh.
The horse is doing most of the extra work.
Okay, so that was an investment. That was helping labor become more productive by...
Well, I would say it's shifting work from labor to capital.
So capital would be the horse. So putting the money... So the company made some money, bought itself a horse, added to its capital ownership... and made labor easier and more productive.
I would say that the laborer is less productive.
The laborer is less productive?
I would say the laborer is doing less work.
Well, but the labor, if you include the horse and the person, is more productive.
We have here two ways of looking at it. If I asked you to represent the horse,
right.
Let's say a lawyer, you would look around and say, hey, look at this worker is doing far less work. And then you take it a step further. Let's suppose you put an ignition key and you turn on an ignition key and you have a truck. You've got 10,000 sacks in the back. And you go 60 miles an hour, you've done 60,000 sack miles worth of work. I mean, no human, you could have, you know, lots of slaves doing that and they wouldn't, I mean, the function of the truck is to do far more work than the laborer.
Right. Okay, so I get that.
The other way of looking at things is to say that the function of capital is not to make labor more productive. The function of capital is to do ever, ever, ever more of the work.
Right. And that makes sense. Of course. Okay.
Let me just step back for a second to give you a comparison. You know, every morning, this is just a comparison.
Yeah.
Every morning we see the sunrise, if you look to the east, and every evening we see the sunset, right?
Right.
It's a complete illusion.
Well, of course.
The sun doesn't rise, the sun doesn't set, the earth spins.
The earth spins, east to west, and then the sun looks like it's moving, of course.
Yeah,
okay.
And so it's a complete illusion. I would say that the idea that capital makes labor more productive is, in a sense, a complete illusion.
Wait, let's slow down because I think this is where like the binary thing. So you're saying capital is not making labor more productive. Capital is, there must be other terms we can use because capital is making what, more production in general and sort of. It's producing more and labor is becoming minimized.
The whole function of technology is to shift work from the human to the non-human.
Right, to actually eventually do away with labor altogether and have a really society of leisure.
That would be that's the notion, and so the function of technology ultimately should be to liberate people.
Yes,
but it's you know when people used to see in the 1850s, you'd see these reapers doing work and machines and the railroads coming in. People had this notion that technology was going to produce abundance and leisure. But how many people have abundance and leisure? Very few.
Well, more people, I think more people than ever in the history of the planet. Of course, there's still a lot of problems, people starving, there's a lot of people, you know, working awful jobs. But, you know, I think slowly more and more people are definitely enjoying the benefits of capital.
Well, I think it is true. I think it is true that capitalism has produced a higher standard of living for numerically more people. Than before, but if you take a look at what its real potential is, as opposed to the reality, yes, we've gotten better, but how much better might it be? Let me sort of take your listeners' understanding another step.
Okay.
Once you recognize that capital does its own share of the work, whatever it may be, that is in what we binary economists would say capital is independently productive.
Okay.
Then you've got capital has six powers that are not understood if you think of capital as only making labor more productive. These are the six powers of capital.
But Robert, can I just ask you one question? The binary term of when you say binary economics, are you going to define that at some point as well?
I would define it right now in a way that's easy for people to understand. There are two different factors of production. There's the labor factor, and there's the capital factor.
If you think
of capital as only making labor more productive, then you have a one-factor society. Capital is dependent, labor is independent. One way, if you have any listeners that understand a little bit about Keynesian economics, he wrote a theory which is really the ideology of the Democratic Party, largely, he distilled, in the general theory, he distilled the economy to time, three variables, time, money, and labor. Capital was a dependent variable, making labor more productive. The binary economist says if you want to distill the economy to time, money, and some sort of production notion, it should be time, money, labor, and capital. Well, labor and capital are then binary factors of production. And the earning capacity of capital isn't only a function of labor. The earning capacity of the horse or the truck or the airplane or anything else has its own productive capacity. It's independent of the productive capacity of labor.
Okay.
And that's what's binary about binary economics.
Okay. Now go to those 6 points that you were... You were going to cite because
Well, the first thing that capital can do is replace labor. So a person can haul a sack, a horse can haul a sack. So capital replaces labor.
That's a good thing, right?
Let me put it to you this way: it's good if you can own the capital that's replacing your labor. But if you can't own the capital that's replacing your labor, it may not be as good as you think.
Well, who would own it if you can't own your own capital?
Well, might be that some capitalist would own it.
You mean like the bank, you're saying?
Or just another investor, just another person.
Oh, so someone else would own the capital, and what would be your job if they own the capital?
You might ultimately be unemployed if we can do the same job with more capital and less labor, then you may be squeezing people out of the production process. And we have a lot of people today who don't have much earning capacity.
Right, but the idea, but if we go back to that idea of creating a society of leisure, ultimately we'd all be out of a job, which would be then kind of have a self-sufficient society. I mean,
if we can all become owners, and that's the question, is there a way in which everybody can become an owner?
Okay, that's actually where we're leading to. That's the new reality that I think this program's all about. So, So go through those points again, the first one.
So the first point is that capital can replace labor. It can do what labor once did.
Okay.
The second power of, but I would say that that's really a misnomer. You almost never only replace labor with capital. Anytime you use a capital instrument, like a horse or a truck, or a shovel or a machine saw or a computer, anytime you use capital to do what labor once did, you not only replace labor, but you vastly supplement labor. We can't compete with horses for hauling or trucks for hauling. We can't compete with a calculator for calculating. We can't compete with a photocopier for copying. Humans
right.
are relatively limited in what they can do.
Well, so, of course, but that was the whole idea of technology in the first place, is to not compete with our technology,
well,
right?
So,
I mean, I don't think we
power,
should be complaining about it. Right.
Well, again, I think the complaint comes is as to whether people have a fair chance to acquire capital.
Well,
That's a further step in the process. Now, so the second thing capital can do is vastly supplement labor production with capital production, do far, far more. The third thing capital can do, it's a power of its own, is capital can do things that labor can never do.
So okay, like what?
Well, for example, a farmer never grew an apple.
Okay. Right.
All a farmer can do is help a tree, which is capital, grow an apple better. But a farmer cannot grow an apple.
Okay, that makes sense.
We can marvel at the computer revolution, but we cannot make a single computer chip because our hands are too big.
Right, but we're designing the machines that are making the computer chip.
Yes, but the machines are making the computer chip.
Right.
You have to give the capital credit for its due.
So when you talk about labor, there has to be someone.
Human input.
Yeah, but there has to be someone supervising the machine, maybe even pushing a button. You know, that's
all of that. But the work of inventing. Listen, the work of inventing.
Yeah.
The work of creating. The work of building. The work of installing. The work of repairing. The work of operating. The work of renovating, the work of managing capital is not the work of the capital. It's separate work.
Okay.
And all that labor work is fine, but the real difference between 1776, 1876, 1976, and 2006, and now 2008, the real difference is all the capital and the work it's doing. The real difference is not the... Now, you might say, well, it takes invention, but once you invented something, then every physical instant... I mean, it's nice to invent a car, but each individual car does its own work. And,
right.
And each individual horse, and each individual truck, and each individual airplane. So the labor work involved here is always a diminishing portion of the total. The only reason to invent and to install and to implement a capital instrument is to produce more, with more productive capital and less labor.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So we got all those things down.
Those are only now three powers of capital. It replaces labor, it vastly supplements labor, and the third thing it does is it does work labor could never do. Fourth thing, capital can work without labor.
Okay,
Think of all the automation that we have. I mean, the work of pressing a button when you do your washing. I mean, try living without your washing machine if you don't think capital does its own work.
Well, sometimes I do my own laundry.
Well, you might, but you spend much more time at it and you work much harder. But the other thing, which you don't do, is you don't carry water on a vase 13 miles. You turn on the faucet.
Exactly.
So the plumbing system is doing a heck of a lot of work, which in poorly underdeveloped countries, people are hauling water.
Right.
So if you have a sense, and if maybe your listeners, think of a movie around the Revolutionary War. That was when Adam Smith wrote. Think about a movie around the Civil War. Think of a movie around the turn of the 1900s, maybe 1900. Think about a movie during the Depression. Think about a movie in the 50s. And think about what we're producing today compared to then. The difference is not labor. The difference is capital. So those are four things that capital can do. And then there are two more wonderful powers. And now we get into the world of money that you talked about before. Capital can buy itself on the promise of its future income.
Capital can, now this is getting into a more sophisticated society if you're going to go there, right?
Yes. And now we're talking about a system with a stable monetary system, which we hope to have.
So repeat that fifth point. Capital can buy itself.
Capital can buy itself on the promise of its future income.
Okay, and what does that do then? The fact
remember we talked about the investor who invests $1 million in a company?
Yeah.
And then sets up, then that company, the managers, maybe it's the investor himself, but he can hire someone to do it. Because that's labor. So the managers take $1 million, invest in machines, tools, and people, in terms of hiring, and then produces. It's the person who gave up his financial capital to invest in real capital is doing so because the promise of the earning capacity of that capital will earn a profit enough to satisfy his appetite for profits. So you only invest in things in the business world that they have the promise of paying for themselves.
Right.
Paying for their own cost of acquisition.
Right, unless you're like someone told me Walmart who buys things so cheap that it's somehow less than the value of it, and they're able to lose money even though it looks like they're making money. But maybe that's a whole other thing.
I'm not sure. I would say that if a business is not investing in things that pay for their own cost of acquisition, their own capital acquisition cost, they're not going to make money in the long run. The whole idea of a capital investment is that it throws off, it promises to earn enough in the future to pay for its acquisition costs plus a reasonable profit. That's the rule of business, to invest in things that competitively pay for themselves.
Well, that's obvious. No one's going to invest in throwaway money. So, okay, the fact that the fifth point is that capital
can buy itself on the promise of its future income.
Right, okay.
And the sixth thing is that capital, at least in theory, when it's in a perfectly frictionless world, the cost of capital acquisition will generate an equal income for somebody else. My expense is your income. My debit is your credit.
Okay, when you say income, how do you define income? Income meaning labor, the result of labor, or where's
and
income
capital,
coming?
And capital. The horse is earning an income. Production is income, at least in a non-monetary sense. Production is income. If it was Robinson Crusoe on an island, what you planted and what you sowed and what you caught with your hands and what you ate, your production is your income. Now, when we have a specialized society, I grow fruit, and you grow. Tomatoes, and I grow vegetables. Mm-hmm. Someone else grows vegetables. We each produce our own things, and we trade. And when you're tired of trading and bartering, we create a money system so that we eliminate that. But production is income. Production is income.
You would say income becomes capital then, or could be, right?
Well, I think capital produces, that is to say real capital.
Yeah.
If it's productive, produces an income. Horses produce, airplanes produce, computers produce, lawnmowers produce. But just as labor produces, so capital produces.
Okay.
So those are six powers of capital.
Okay.
To replace labor, to vastly supplement labor, to do work that labor can't do, to work without labor, to buy itself on its future income, and to distribute the income necessary to purchase its output. Those are the six theoretical powers of capital. They get dragged down by the frictions of our economy, but those are all six powers. Now, when you put those all together, what we are trying to do, and now I'm looking at 1776, 1876, 1976, we are trying to distribute the mass production of increasingly productive capital and a diminishing need for labor. We're trying to distribute purchasing power to support that productive capacity through jobs and welfare.
When you say welfare, what does that mean, welfare?
That welfare is taxing those who are producing and giving it to people who are not producing.
That's where a government comes in.
That's where, well, it's one of the ways, places where government. Now, it's not, you know, we could talk about welfare for the poor. We get a lot of welfare for the rich, too.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of government taxing the middle class to support both the rich and poor. So,
why does the rich need support?
Let me put it this way. They enjoy support.
Yeah, but why do they? Why would the government give support to the rich if they, especially
well,
if they
have
enough?
Well, you have to ask them. That we still have farm, you know, we still have farm subsidies. We still have lots of advantages that help the rich. I think there is a whole psychology that if you give advantages to the rich, those advantages will trickle down into more jobs and welfare.
You don't believe that. That was Reaganomics. That was an awful thing. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
I'm not advocating. I'm just suggesting
No, but that's an awful thing. I think it's just stupid to suggest that, you know, it's basically based on greed. We have money. We want to keep our money. You know, it seems like something gets thrown off in the economy when those tax breaks and money is given back to the rich because they're building capital on top of capital, and the ones that need those breaks are then forfeiting and then have to be reduced to labor, it seems.
Well, it gets down to this proposition, it seems to me, and I think you're on the right track. What the most important? Let me approach it a slightly different way, because I am ultimately a lawyer that studied economics, and because I'm concerned about poor and working people and their welfare, there is a right which the rich enjoy, and the poor theoretically have, but they don't enjoy very much. It is and I think it's the most important right that people do not understand. It is the right to acquire capital with the earnings of capital.
The poor have that right as well as the rich.
But only the rich can use that right effectively in our
because
society.
The rich have access to capital where the poor doesn't have access
because,
to capital.
Because the rich have access to credit and also ownership of existing capital.
Oh,
expecting,
I see.
That is to say, expecting the poor to how do we tell the poor to acquire capital? Well, work hard, save, invest wisely. To expect the poor to acquire capital with labor in competition with the rich who are acquiring capital with capital is like expecting a poor person to compete for hauling sacks with a horse.
It's a ridiculous proposition to begin with.
It cannot be done. Now here's the single thing about binary economics, which if I could just put it in a single sentence, is what is remarkably new about binary economics and remarkably promising, and will ultimately get us out of this terrible crisis that you and I started talking about, with different kinds of causes, which I don't think are as fundamental. Here is the proposition. And it starts with a proposition that is not controversial.
Okay.
And that is the promise of that capital will buy itself on its future income. The promise to invest assumes a earning capacity in the future.
Yes,
you only invest in a capital instrument today to produce something that you're going to sell tomorrow.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it takes time to build a tool. So while the tool is being built, while the factory is being built, while the company is being formed, it's not current income that's supporting that. It's the promise of future income.
Okay, I got you. So someone's investing in a potential. Yes. Okay.
In a future. Now, and so my proposition, and this is what Adam Smith didn't see, and what Karl Marx didn't see, the one who brought us communism, and what Alfred Marshall, who brought us what we call the neoclassical theory, which is largely the ideology of the Republican Party, and Keynesian theory, the Democratic Party's ideology, all those theories. They don't understand that the promise of broader ownership in the future, because broader ownership in the future means broader distribution of capital earnings to people who need money to buy. The
right.
promise of broader ownership in the future will soak up unused capacity and promote more capacity in the present.
Okay, make that simpler. Just make it simpler on the basic human level.
I will try to say it simpler, but in a way, some things you just have to say two or three times and let them sink in.
Okay.
The more broadly capital is acquired with the earnings of capital.
The more broadly you mean, meaning?
The more broadly the ownership of capital.
The more, let's say you have a company, and the more ownership in the company, you would say?
That's right. The more broadly that the capital of that company is owned by more and more people.
Okay.
But think of America's 3,000 largest companies, or
okay.
the world's 6,000. When you talk about America's 3,000 largest companies, you're talking about 90% of the investable capital in America.
Mm-hmm.
So think of this diversified portfolio of let's say the Russell 3000 of American companies. The more broadly, every year that capital buys more capital. And every
okay.
year that capital base gets bigger. It's very rare that you have recessions where this capital base begins to go down over any extended period. It's rare. It happens, but it's very rare. The
okay.
more broadly capital is acquired, that creates a promise of a broader distribution of capital earnings in the future. Which means the broader distribution of capital earnings in the future means that people will have more money to buy the consumer goods that can be produced by capital. Broader ownership will soak up unused capacity and promote economic growth. And that's a principle that neither the left wing, which is largely the ideology of Keynes, or the economics of Keynes, and the right wing, which is largely the ideology of neoclassical economics, personified recently by people like Milton Friedman and others, that don't understand this. But the more broadly capital is acquired, then we will both soak up unused capacity and promote growth.
So put that into practical terms then, the more broadly. So how can people have more ownership?
Well, again, it's a little bit hard to describe on the radio without
the charts. I know
without
you have,
charts, but nevertheless, you can say that what the rich use to acquire capital with the earnings of capital are six mechanisms. First of all, they use corporations.
Yes.
Because the corporation has limited liability. You make a loss, you only lose what you've invested. They don't come and hock your house for that. You have credit, loans from banks. You have insurance to insure against risk.
Uh-huh.
You have managers in the form of corporate managers and trustees. And you have the central bank, in our case the Federal Reserve, that keeps a stable money supply. Those same six institutions can enable poor people to acquire capital just as rich people do.
So then how would that work? Just use poor people or use the people that don't have access to capital. How would they start to acquire capital in a practical way?
I think it has to begin with, first of all, a different understanding of what our economic situation is, and that would start with both the poor and the rich. Remember I said that capital buys itself on the promise of its future income.
Yes.
Looking at the situation from a sort of global perspective or a national perspective, the capital that now buys itself for the rich can buy itself even more profitably if more people are cut into the process.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes, so I really want to get to the core of how everyone then can benefit. So yes. So how do more people get involved?
But again, we have to sort of transform ourselves into a different understanding. Every American company today, most creditworthy American companies today, could produce more of what they're producing.
Yes.
At lower unit costs, if only people had the money to buy.
Right.
If you were to go to General Motors and say, could you produce more cars?
Uh-huh.
If only people had the money at lower unit costs.
So wait, people, people, but you already said we have overproduction and less spending. That's right.
We already have excess capacity.
We have
capacity because we've strangled people out of production over the years for the very same reason. We're trying to buy what is increasingly produced by capital, while people are continually shut out of the capital acquisition.
Wait, so the only thing you're saying, right, I mean, the thing that you're saying mostly is that they produce the same, it's just let's give access to the capital to a broader amount of people. Is that what you're saying?
If you cut more and more people into the process by which capital is acquired with the earnings of capital.
And how do you do that?
You would do it ultimately with what's called capital credit. Right now, America's 3,000 largest companies acquire almost all their capital with the earnings of capital. They use retained earnings for about 70% of their capital acquisition. They use borrowed money for about 25% or so of their capital acquisition, and they sell stock for about 5%. So they're using borrowed money. But that's borrowed money by existing owners that are borrowing money and earning more on the money and then repaying loans.
Right.
The credit function, you could extend capital credit to poor and working people. You could insure the risk of business failure through an institution called capital credit insurance. Right now we insure capital acquisition for the rich, but not for the poor.
That's really critical, I think, is that these points you're making for how the poor can acquire capital, you know.
With capital credit.
We're
awash in consumer credit. You can open up your mailbox every day and someone wants to sell you a credit card. And we're also, and this goes back to the housing crisis, we've been awash in mortgage credit, and it really went overboard because people were saying, we'll keep on loaning because we think the values of this bubble real estate is going to go up and up when obviously can't go up forever and ever without increasing income to support consumer income, citizen income to support it. But we have no capital credit. We don't have capital credit for the poor. We give capital
credit. So how can we create capital? Because we have about 5 more minutes. Let's talk about how we can increase the ownership of the poor and increase the capital and create a society of leisure.
Well, what we need is a different fundamental understanding of economic theory.
And tell me about that. That's really
what we've been talking about most of this time. Once you understand that capital is producing most of the wealth and that it can buy itself on the promise of its future income, and that the only thing that prevents it from being more productive and being more profitably employed is that its ownership is concentrated, and that if we broaden ownership, it will become even more productive and more profitable. Once that understanding is there, then we will stop trying to solve the income problems by wages and welfare, and we will open up the very mechanisms that enrich the rich to enable them to enrich everybody.
Right. So
the practical way of
ownership through consumerism, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm really saying using the very same techniques of corporate finance that enable corporations to acquire assets before they earn the money to buy them, and that enable rich people to benefit from that, would operate even more profitably if we cut poor and working people into it. It is not a zero-sum game.
So how would we do that? How would we cut the poor? How would we get the poor more part of capital? What's a practical way?
Well, again, in order to have loans of these sorts to poor and working people, you're not going to loan to people individually. You'd have trusts borrowing for the benefit of poor and working people. So just as a company now seeks to expand its productive capacity, it would see it's in its interest to cut in the poor working people. So loans would go to a trust. The trust would invest in stock of the company. The company would make its investment that it would otherwise have made without the broader ownership. The profits will repay the lender, and after the profits have been used to repay the lender, the stock that was financed that way now begins earning income for poor and working people. And
what?
That promise of broader ownership will soak up unused capacity and promote even more economic growth.
Wait, so we take an automobile company and their sales are going down. So what they do is set up a loan to the people. Is that what you're saying?
Through a trust mechanism.
To a trust.
Like a deferred compensation plan. We have these ESOPs today, which are kind of a prototype. But a loan would go to a trust. The trust would invest in stock of the company. The company would take the funds that it could have borrowed directly, but it will invest in whatever tools it would invest in, assuming that it is the same. It makes the same profit it would have made with stationary ownership. It's now distributing income to enable the poor and working people to acquire the stock, and after it's paid for, it produces an income.
Now, do you see
supports more consumption?
See, I mean, we're almost out of time here. Do you see this as a universally possible to build a new society from?
I think it's yes, but it simply starts with a different understanding. There's no reason to do this if you don't understand that capital and labor are independently productive, that capital is doing more and more of the work, and it has the capacity to distribute the income to purchase what capital can produce. We have tons of unused capacity that we don't use. We have inventions on the drawing board that people can't afford to put into place. We have an incredible capacity that nobody even talks about. It looks as though we're stingy and starving. People are starving because they're kept out of the capital acquisition process.
Wow.
I realize it's hard to visualize because it's like saying, look at the sunrise, and explaining to people, well, you know, it's the earth that's spinning. You're starding with a false premise. Capital does not make labor more productive.
Right. No, we're just laying out the concepts, and hopefully we could do some more shows in the future where this will be archived on bbsradio.com and also on newrealities.com. And so people understand these basic concepts, then we can go deeper into the equal, sort of a more fair distribution of capital. Right? I mean, that's where we're heading.
A more equal access to capital acquisition. So your starting question of why do we have this housing crisis and why do we have this crisis today can be looked at in superficial terms. People buying what they can't afford, people getting low hooker loans at 5% and then jumping to 10, people fraudulently selling these things on the market without expressing, people expecting a bubble and then to keep on going rising, but it busts. But these are superficial, much more superficial causes, greed. I mean, those things all exist. But what is not talked about is that we have this huge productive capacity that we don't even use. And we don't use it because almost all capital is acquired with the earnings of capital. 1% of the people in our society own 50% of the capital, roughly. 10% or 90%, and that leaves 90% scrambling for what's left.
So the whole idea behind binary economics is the equal distribution of wealth, which will lead to a more
not equal, but enabling everybody to compete for capital acquisition on fair terms.
It will not be
an equal distribution, and nor is there any redistribution. It's just enabling the poor to compete with the rich for capital acquisition. The poor bring something to the corporations that the rich don't have. The poor bring the promise of pent-up consumer demand for food, clothing, shelter, transportation, reasonable, simple creature comforts. The world today lives on $3 a day, so many people. If we could increase the earning capacity of the world to $6 a day, there'd be a global boom.
Right.
We have this huge productive capacity that we don't use. We're strangling the economy by hoarding capital acquisition to a concentrated group of people.
Well, thank you, Robert. I really appreciate your work. Do you have a website that people can reach you at?
They can certainly go to Syracuse University, and they'll find me on that website. You'll find links to my some of my writings.
Mm-hmm.
They can also go to ssrn.com and just put my name in, Robert Ashford, mm-hmm. and you'll get 6 or 7 articles. There's the Center for Economic and Social Justice. There are a number mm-hmm. of websites on binary economics.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book with Rodney Shakespeare called Binary Economics, The New Paradigm, which is available for sale, but a lot of free literature. I want to thank you very much.
Yeah, now this really laid out the situation. I really appreciate that. We'll definitely have you back in some upcoming shows, and we'll go deeper into how to solve the economic crisis through these new paradigms.
Well, you've been very kind to give it some attention. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. I've been talking to Robert Ashford, who's a law professor at Syracuse University, but also very much behind the binary economic movement here, and he's at Syracuse University. My name's Alan Steinfeld, and you can reach me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you very much for listening to New Realities, and see you next week.